I'm Steven Steigman, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. You've probably heard there's something big going on in the state north of us, something about presidential politics, people getting together for cookies and conversation. Don't worry, this isn't another show about the Iowa caucuses. It's a program about how the news media are covering it. What responsibility does the news have to make these political stories relevant? And what's our obligation to get it right? Also, the economy is looking up, up, up. For TV stations, that is. Our critics discuss what campaign ads mean for a station's bottom line. And we ask, does local coverage suffer when so much attention is focused on national races? It's Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is away this week. Unless you haven't been paying attention to the news at all in the last couple of weeks, you know that today is the very first presidential primary contest, the Iowa caucuses. You've probably heard enough by now, but don't worry, it's not quite over, as today and throughout the week, the news will probably rehash what happened with our neighbors to the north and what it means for the pack of candidates seeking the Republican nomination. Today, our media critics are back for another take on this, a look at how campaign fatigue might just kick in a bit early, and what our job is as the news media to ensure that you're engaged and what we get and that we do get our facts straight. We'll also kick around some other topics like last year's big stories and what they mean for this year. A question: does local news coverage suffer when so much focus is on the national stage? And how do TV stations do in a presidential election year? The quick answer, ka-ching. Our media critics are Derek Donovan of the Kansas City Star. He's the newspaper's reader's representative. Derek, Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Sylvia Maria Gross is producer and co-host of Casey Currents, heard here on KCUR Sundays at 5 and Monday evenings at 8. Sylvia, Feliz Ano Novo.
Feliz Ano Novo, Steve.
Did I get that okay?
Yes,
okay.
Very good.
And joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City is guest media critic David Perlmutter. He's director of the University of Iowa's School of Journalism and Mass Communications. David, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for asking me back.
David Perlmutter, Iowa is getting a major influx of candidates and cash over the last few months. I'd like to start here. We've always seen a huge immigration of media from across the U.S. this time of the year, every 4 years. What's it been like this year?
Well, I think it's been saturation coverage, saturation advertising, but also saturation presence. You know, it's almost impossible to not bump into journalists from out of state or political candidates swinging by, maybe because there's so many Republican candidates this year in Iowa and they're focusing so much on the state and have for so long. It feels like we've gone through a general election for the last year and a half or more.
Well, how exciting is it for Iowans, ordinary citizens, to see these candidates? And kind of along the same lines, how exciting is it for them to see all these kind of well-known news personalities occasionally?
Well, I think this is also a defense of Iowa as the first major contest in the presidential nomination race, is that Iowans actually care a lot. They take their responsibility very seriously. You don't hear a lot of cynicism. I mean, there's some jokes about, you know, well, I'm not sure I want to vote for Romney. I've only met him 5 times, you know, so that sort of thing, which happens every 4 years. But people have very serious conversations. They care. They debate. They go to events. They read and listen. You can see the volatility of the electorate. Well, that's an electorate that's actually paying attention to information, to reading newspapers and listening to social media. And I just think that Iowans do a really good job of at least hearing out the candidates and making decisions.
Well, you were quoted recently about attack ads. Quote, "I call it ad wars whack-a-mole, this endless attacking in all directions, trying to slam down anyone who is surging to the top." Would this fly in Iowa 10 years ago?
Absolutely not. In fact, if you'd shown me some of these ads 10 years ago. And I've always been interested in, I've been teaching political communication for 20 years, and I've always been interested in Iowa because Iowa, the year before the presidential race, is sort of the testing ground for a lot of new political strategies as well as for the candidates. So I would have easily said 10 years ago that, no, you can't run an ad like that in Iowa. That would just never work.
What about the ads? Tell me, give me an example of an ad that just wouldn't
Have ads where religion is probably more foregrounded than I've ever seen it, where somebody talks about their faith directly and really just sort of making an absolute appeal, vote for me because I'm a member of this religion. You have just absolutely strong negatives. And this, I mean, everything short of this person is, you know, Satan's personal representative on the planet. And again, this is – now, I spent 10 years in Louisiana, so I would – which
you
is
know
pretty, a pretty
politics,
tough state
yeah.
for political ads. So I would say we've become Louisiana grade in at least the ads that they are being run. Now, a lot of them are being run, again, by the campaigns, which are run from mostly out-of-state people, and by the super PACs especially, which are out-of-state. So you can't blame Iowans for this. This is a national campaign that's happening in our back door.
Hmm. Is Iowa changing as a result, or is Iowa much the same state it was, you know, 4, 8, 12 years ago?
Well, Iowa has changed. There's been a demographic shift, you know, an increasing migration in from some people from out-of-state. You see there's a greater Hispanic presence, for example. I think the electorate is changing in some senses that we realize that in contested races, there's just going to be a lot of negative advertising. So, again, it's not that people are saying, oh, well, we're so happy that there are all these negative ads here, is that I think there's more of an acceptance. Well, I guess this is the way politics works in 2012.
Hmm. I recently read an article about Iowa in the Atlantic magazine by your colleague Stephen Bloom, which got quite a response to say the least. And the New York Times' Gail Collins piped in about the importance or lack thereof of Iowa. What's your take?
Well, again, I'm speaking to somebody who has not any connection to Iowa. My wife is Iowan. But I have been coming back here during the summers before elections, and now I get to live here and watch the year before the caucus. Again, I'm not sure who else should have this job. You know, Iowans have worked very hard for the position of being the first people to really solidly, deeply look over candidates. And I just think that they take that job, as I said, very, very seriously. And it's like a lot of things, you know, if you want to change it, what would be better? I mean, do we really want California and you have to spend $500 million on the very first contest in a super ad war? I'm just not sure what would be a better system than letting people here do the job.
Is the Iowa Visitors Bureau doing their job in promoting Iowa, the real side of Iowa? Does the national media get it right about Iowa and its citizens?
Oh, you know, it's so easy to fall into stereotypes. I mean, last night on MSNBC, there was a very interesting feature about how farm prices are booming because the farm economy is booming. And Iowa is actually doing pretty well compared to other states. So I think there's some realization that it's much more complex than some 1980 stereotype of farms going broke and, you know, poor people and everything. So if you come to Iowa, I don't see how anybody could come here from outside, traveling the state, covering it, and not notice that it's a lot more complex than any stereotype that you might hold about the state.
Hmm. And Derek and Sylvia, I'm going to ask you a similar question. When you see national reporters come through Kansas City, through either Missouri or Kansas, do you see these attitudes about, you know, these provincial attitudes that sometimes that we hear about?
Well, I think, I mean, in working with editors, there is sometimes this pre-scripted story that they might want to hear, a national editor might want to hear about Kansas City or mm-hmm. about Missouri and the type of person. We're going to go to Kansas City to find this type of person. Hmm. And that doesn't always represent what Kansas City is. It's a very urban place and, you know, and of course, the complexity of issues that there are here.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of it really just has to do with how much good homework the journalists have done. If you've got somebody who really has a clue about anything, they're not going to come to any subject really with any kind of a preconceived notion. One of the things I've always found amusing is that by far the most provincial media I ever read is the stuff that's based in Manhattan. And you know, I especially think about...
And we're talking Manhattan,
New York City, right. Okay. I especially think about if anybody reads any of the Gawker media sites, you know, it is truly hilarious sometimes to find how small some of those folks' worlds actually are. And it's kind of the joke that we all tend to make around here that when there's a blackout in New York City, that's national news. And whereas a blackout in even Pittsburgh or Chicago, something like that, you know, would not tend to be. And also, I think you have to look at the types of stories that they're coming here to cover. The Lisa Irwin case, for example, you know, you can't really use that as any kind of a barometer because that is a story that doesn't really have anything in particular to do with Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And I think the coverage that I saw had such a variety of voices that I didn't really perceive any type of a bias that they were bringing to it. But, you know, when you're talking about somebody who might be looking at an actual trend story, I saw a national story about the murder rate in Kansas City a couple of years ago that was done, I think, by CBS. But at any rate, it was extremely nuanced and had a lot of insight about what was going on in this community.
Hmm. Derek Donovan, have you heard much from Kansas City Star readers about the Iowa caucuses or how the paper has been covering the 2012 race so far?
There has already been an expression of ennui about it. People saying, gosh, why are you giving this right now, which is so preliminary, so much attention. But then on the other hand, you know, I have found the political junkies tend to engage with me more than they do probably with the general population. They are very keenly interested in what the Star has to say about these things because there are a lot of people for whom this is a major preoccupation and they can't possibly get enough of it.
And in some ways, this is not just a national story. This is a local story. I mean, Iowa is our backyard, kind of.
Exactly right. I mean, it's not in the Star's normal coverage area, but of course, anybody who's been reading the paper this week knows that, you know, the Star is there right now, and this is the type of thing that the Star always does cover, right?
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Steven Steigman. We're talking with our media critics today. Sylvia Maria Gross of KCUR, how is public radio covering the campaign compared to 4 years ago, in your opinion?
Well, I was just thinking about – I don't think that there's been a huge change in the news cycle. The sort of 24-hour or really minute-by-minute news cycle was in place already 4 years ago. And with the one assertion made and a reaction needing to happen within 24 hours from the other candidate, that was already happening 4 years ago. We had social media in play. So I don't know that that has changed so much. There's probably a lot more social media involved in terms of how reporters are covering campaigns. Mm. I think that there has been, over the past 4 years, a lot of coverage of campaign finance issues and the changes that have come federally in terms of how campaigns can be financed and the organizations that can finance campaigns. And NPR has done a lot of good coverage of sort of following the money or trying to follow the money on that. But I don't know that there's been major changes.
Well, let me ask you let me ask all three of you this. What have we learned about covering presidential campaigns? What are we doing differently now than we were 4, 8, or 12 years ago? David Perlmutter?
Well, of course, now we live in an age of instant accessibility and instant demand for everything. Any story gets put up faster than before. I'm very worried about the dropping standards of journalism in the sense that stuff is just slapped up on the web and on social media too fast.
Without an edit.
Well, I'm not sure anybody, including the writer, is editing it sometimes for all the grammatical errors and all the factual errors that I see. And that's of great concern, and it should be for anyone who cares about journalism and the country. But also in terms of politics, there used to be a rule that, you know, you got to have your own counter ad in the can ready to respond if a candidate comes out with an attack ad. And now, I mean, the response really has to be within like 24 minutes, let alone 24 hours, because just the flow of attack and counterattack is just so fast. It truly is like, I mean, we always use the metaphor of a battle or a war, but it really is like a battle where, you know, somebody charges the cavalry on the right, you got to respond instantly.
Derek, when you receive a complaint from a reader about coverage of a particular issue or a topic, do you approach reporters and ask them to follow up? And does that have any influence on what they end up covering in the future?
Well, you know, it's difficult to make any kind of a blanket statement such as that because every type of complaint is so different. Some of them, if they're about a factual error, I don't even really need to talk to the reporter, to be honest.
Right.
You know, if there's a correction that needs to be written, I don't consult with them. I just do it. However, I do often see people who express interest in saying, why don't you pin down this person on this specific thing? I can think of two or three stories involving Sam Brownback and Claire McCaskill over the past few years that have arisen specifically because a reader has said, you need to figure out what's going on with this program, with the diversion of funds in Kansas. You need to figure out what Claire's real position is on this, that have resulted in actual stories. The number of suggestions that turn into actual journalism that come directly from readers is pretty surprising to a lot of people. And again, that just speaks to the people who are very plugged in, who actually are able to look at the politicians and the candidates' own words now, and I attribute a lot of that to the availability of social media, who are able then to go to the source materials and then come back to the journalists who have access to those people in ways that the general public might not to generate journalism. So it's a really great type of new collaboration possibility.
Sure. Sylvia, are you seeing an uptick in people contacting you via social media about potential stories more so than you would receive, let's say, phone calls in the past?
Yeah, well, I haven't been a journalist for quite long enough to – I mean, I sort of saw the growth of social media but you know, email, and that was already there. So I think it was already – we were already pretty accessible. But yeah, more and more, I mean, I think on Twitter or Facebook, people just – kind of one-off it. They think of it and they just write it immediately, as opposed to even an email you think about a little bit more before you draft and send.
Well, Derek, please.
You know, and that actually brings me something to really astute that David said a few minutes ago, where he's talking about the accelerating news timing cycle and how quickly stuff is put out there these days and how he's concerned about that. I'm not sure that everybody fully understands how fast that cycle has become to a point that I think it is fairly ridiculous. I was in a part of a conversation with a group of young business people and journalists last month where this topic of breaking news came up and how important these things are. And the point was made by a fellow panelist that In this day and age, everybody participates in the breaking news, but nobody really owns it any longer. And it's because you go search Twitter for anything that is breaking right now, and you will see, you know, sometimes hundreds and thousands of people who are, quote, breaking it just within a matter of minutes of each other. So I do think it becomes incumbent upon professional journalists who take their craft seriously to filter it. I don't personally believe anybody cares who got a story first most of the time. If a big investigation, yeah. But when you're talking about, you know, somebody declaring their presidency or any of these types of things that become just sort of the currency of the daily news, I think getting it right and getting it with the proper context becomes much more important. And that's the thing where I think professional journalists need to refocus and start to build their own personal brand of credibility in that.
Sylvia Maria Gross.
I think it also has to do with who it's – if you're thinking about the news junkie or the political junkie you were talking about before who is generating hundreds of thousands of page hits and, you know, really consuming this media or, you know, most average citizens who might check into the news once or twice a day, a few times a day, or maybe just in the morning, maybe just in the evening. Many people – they want to see what's going on in my world, in – the country, in my city, but they're not checking minute by minute.
David Perlmutter, how is this changing the way you teach journalism at the University of Iowa?
Oh, I think that there's been a sea shift, yes, in the way that journalism is taught. And there's a really nuanced balance that we have to achieve. On the one hand, I would argue that everything that we teach at journalism schools about integrity and ethics and responsibility and accuracy and hard work to get the good sources is still true as in 1980. But, of course, we have the challenges of the speed, of all the new platforms and venues, of technologies. You know, once upon a time in journalism schools, when I went to a communications program, you train one person to be a video cameraman for TV news, and they probably carry that big camera around for their entire careers. Now our students are asked to be, as many employers have put it to me, one-woman bands, where one person is asked to deal with all the technologies, rewrite the same story for 50 different platforms. So speed, versatility. It's really, really accelerated everything in our own teaching. But again, I always tell our students this. Look, there's billions of people on Facebook who are giving content away for free. If you really want to be paid for your content, it's going to have to be better than everyone else's. And this is my pitch to journalism, is that if you want to survive, if you want to have people actually pay to subscribe to your content, it has to be better, not just faster.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. If you'd like to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us. Our address is uptodate@kcur.org. Feel free to shoot us an email complaining about what we're doing today. So given all these resources that citizens have at their fingertips, namely the internet, coverage from print, TV, radio, elsewhere, are voters any more informed? Derek?
I think it's pretty difficult to argue anything counter to that. We like to romanticize how civically engaged people used to be in the past, but the fact of the matter was, especially when you're talking about the middle of the 20th century and before, there was an extremely monolithic media that people heard that often, for example, you're talking about war coverage, was actually actively being censored as it was, you know, coming through the government. People don't understand, I don't think, the way the professional media has evolved over the past 60, 70 years and just how wide a variety of different sources there are now that are attempting not to be partisan. Now, of course, you go 100 years ago and newspapers were in open war as much as they still are in South America and in Europe with actively partisan voices. Mm-hmm. Today, you do have a certain amount of that in America, particularly, I would argue, in cable TV news. But in general, when you're talking about the mainstream sources, they are attempting to be as down the middle as possible. And I think that there are just so many more venues for people to find the information these days that I find it difficult to argue that people are not probably more privy to the actual source documents, as I keep coming back to saying, than they ever have been before.
Sylvia?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is so much information available, but if you're watching or if you're just tuning in a little, then you're seeing the same story over and over again. And so I think people tend to feel like they're being sort of bombarded with the same thing and get bored of it, even though there is a wealth of information available mm-hmm. for the people who are working to find it. But then it's sort of asking them to serve as their own journalist.
Mm-hmm. And there's another side to that also, that there is a sort of information ghetto people sometimes lock themselves into, where I've seen studies that have indicated that people who are very partisan about their political beliefs do tend to read both sides. I'm not sure I personally believe that, or if they do read both sides, that they actually give any credence to it. I think that we have so many capabilities to customize the news that we get according to what our preconceived notions are, that I think there's a real danger that people start to believe one viewpoint much more strongly than they do another, and almost to the point where they're only looking at the other one as something to set up straw men to knock down. So there's always that danger that when you're especially going to certain bloggers or folks who are spinning the news with a commentary purpose, that you're going to get a skewed view on what are correct facts.
Mm-hmm. David Perlmutter from the University of Iowa, your students are starting there at age 18, 19. Where are they getting their news versus those who are in grad school and working on their PhD?
Well, I think this particular entry class to the University of Iowa and to KU and to University of Missouri is psychographically different than even 3 or 4 years ago, the students. If you think about it, if you're 18 now, that means you pretty much have spent your entire tween and teen years in the era of social media. Mm. Which really didn't start until the early zeros and really 2004, 2005. So they have been raised on social media. And, you know, I'll talk to them. I'm teaching a winter semester class on the caucus and social media right now. And I'll ask the people in the room, how many people here watch the evening news? Zero. You know, how many people read a newspaper that's not the student newspaper? One. You know, who's from China? You know.
Right.
So they are getting almost everything from Facebook, from other social media sources. Now, very much it may be aggregated, may have originated on, you know, Russia Today or Google somewhere, but they're just not processing and gathering information the way that I did or really students 5 years ago did.
Sylvia? Are you hearing from, I guess when you hear from listeners to KC Currents, where are they getting their news from? From us, obviously, if they're listening to us. Where else are they? Are you seeing these differences in generations?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a difference in generation. I don't know how much I'm in contact with the younger generation the way David is, but I mean, public radio listeners do tend to listen to a lot of public radio and sort of focus in there. And I think a lot of our listeners are counting on public radio to sort of be a digest for the other media and maybe not branching out as much to reading the newspapers. And I mean, I think more and more people in their 30s, which is where I am, are unfortunately abandoning or never really started newspaper reading. And so think that one source might be enough.
Derek, are efforts by The Star, and I'll ask all of you the same question, by local news media to keep in touch via social media with non-traditional readers or viewers and listeners, is that working? Is there a way to measure their success?
Well, you know, The Star is pretty active on those fronts, and I wish I actually were a little bit more knowledgeable about that, because there are folks there who are extremely plugged into what our actual numbers are. I think it's a very different audience from the audience that I speak to. For one thing, the audience that I interact with on a daily basis is solicited, and these are people who are basically volunteering, whereas a lot of social media is a very passive medium. And we don't really know exactly how much input some of those things happen unless people are retweeting them or commenting on them.
And the other aspect of that, I think, is that if people are getting their news and from social media that's pointing to a huge variety of news sources, they're tending to get a lot more national news and international news than local news. And I think that that's where the real vacuum is. They're not learning about what's happening in their local community. And I think I know people who live here in Kansas City who may be reading the New York Times online and feel like they're catching up with what's going on, but are not quite sure who's mayor of Kansas City.
Interesting. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more with our media critics. We'll talk about local stories and how it's easy to lose sight of the local stories during a presidential campaign year. And we'll also talk about what commercials mean for TV stations this election cycle. I'm Steven Steigman, sitting in for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steven Steigman. Steve Kraske is away this week. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the year ahead in environmental news. Is one of your New Year's resolutions to reduce, reuse, or recycle? Join us tomorrow for that topic. This hour, we're visiting with the media critics. We're talking about everything news-related, but specifically campaigns and their news cycles. Our guests are Derek Donovan, the reader's representative from the Kansas City Star, Sylvia Maria Gross, producer and co-host of KC Currents, heard here on KCUR, and David Perlmutter, director of the University of Iowa's School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Well, I want to move on to a topic that I think some of us don't like to talk about. It's kind of easy to lose perspective during a presidential campaign year. Eyes are focused on national races for the White House and Congress. Do we lose focus on national stories? Derek, I'll start with you.
Lose focus on national stories?
I'm sorry. Do we lose focus on local stories? Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's a very real danger of that. And as newspapers continue to evolve, I know that the mantra around The Star is that what we need to cover most carefully is the Kansas City area, because that is what anybody in this city has unique to us. And I think that, for example, what's going on in the schools, I think that there's basically no ceiling to how much you could possibly cover in that. What Mayor James is proposing is one of the most radical changes to how Kansas City, Missouri schools have been organized in history. And I think that it has tremendous value and import to the community. And I'm not certain that, from what I'm hearing, I'm seeing as much reader interest in that. And so you've got one of these classic cases of, do you give people their vegetables or do you give people the stuff that they're seeing elsewhere and that they might be more likely to pick up a newspaper to read?
Well, that's a great question for our listeners. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also post on KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Do you want to hear more local stories, or in a presidential campaign cycle, do you just want to hear more presidential campaign stories? Sylvia Maria Gross, what are local stations and papers doing to make national stories relevant and interesting?
Well, it isn't just a presidential campaign. It's a
congressional
election.
Sure,
there
of course.
Are,
lots of seats, many
local races. And I think that that's a key time to really try and get people engaged in what's happening in their local state legislature, in their, you know, our city election cycle is on a different cycle. But in state races, state politics, and the challenge is to try and make those stories, which are about people that people are already probably not as familiar with, interesting, kind of human, appealing, and the impact, the importance of the decisions that these people are making in your lives, be it a state representative, a state senator, or governor, or your senator. You know, there's a senatorial race in Missouri. Claire McCaskill is up for re-election.
Versus we don't know yet, but, you know, that's what's going to be decided in the next 6 months. When's it? April. Anyway, things start to heat up around then. Well, David Perlmutter, are you teaching students to keep their eye on the local as well as the national?
Oh, sure. And they're interested in local just as much as anyone else. I do think that there is a struggle, as a couple of people have said before, that, you know, news by its nature tends to be more interested in what's new. And it's harder to cover sort of slow-moving, not visually interesting big stories that continue to affect us. I think that the real estate crisis, which still is a crisis, which every once in a while we keep being pointed out to us, is this slow-moving glacier that is, you know, creeping down the country, where one-third of homeowners are underwater in their mortgage, and everything and everyone will be affected by that. But would you put that on the front page every day? I mean, do you keep saying, well, gee, nobody still solved this problem? We're a couple of years into it. It's very tough for journalists to cover that and for people to sustain interest in it. But it's an example of a story that really you can't, again, to use the gentleman's phrase, you know, there's no ceiling on how much you could spend focusing on it.
We know from history that public radio sees an increase in listenership during an election cycle. Do we also see that in TV and newspapers, Derek Donovan?
Well, you know, I'm not personally privy to the numbers, to be honest. I could find them if I wanted to. I do know that I certainly see an intensification of the feedback that I get. And there's absolutely no question you can graph it when you look at the years. I recall during the second Bush election, the feedback that I got during that was probably, I would say, the most intense. There would be days where my phone was literally ringing about election coverage the second that I hung it up. And so people really focus on those things. Again, this is because these are part of the national debate, and people really tend to use the presidential elections as proxies for their personal belief systems in general, and so I think they can get very invested in an emotional way about it as well. But that does mean that they're watching the news.
Do news directors come to the table with a different idea of what's important during an election cycle? That question makes sense. Do we say, okay, well, we know we've got these local stories to cover, but we've got this big election looming over us. How do we attack that first? Does that sound accurate?
When you're talking specifically about the Star, and I'm sure that Sylvia can talk more about KCOR and David can talk about it in the broader context, but always the question is going to be at the Star when you're at that afternoon news meeting. This is what people are talking about. How do you make it relevant to Kansas City specifically? This is the concept of localization of news. Again, what I referred to before, how people continue to ask, what can the Star bring to it that others cannot? Sometimes I think you do get yourself into a little bit of a sort of a shoehorning situation where you're kind of creating an artificial construct, and I think you need to watch out for that.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, and I, on Casey Currents, prefer not to localize national stories very often. I prefer to, you know, localize local stories, and just because there, you know, I feel like there is such there's not enough local news, and there's always more stories we can cover, and the challenge is to do them well. But and so with an election coming up, I feel like, oh great, 30 races, which one do we cover besides the national races?
Right.
But on the other hand, you go out to dinner and everybody's talking about the national race, and you feel like you need to reflect that in your show in a way that is what's happening in Kansas City, because it's on the minds of people in Kansas City. So it is often a challenge to find that angle of, well, how is this looking different in Kansas City? How are Kansas Cityans coming at this differently? Or we've done stories on how are people just changing their lives around the election. So profiles of local people who are getting involved and maybe changing their lives because of a certain campaign, changing careers or becoming politicized sort of for the first time. And I think those can be really interesting.
But there are these.
I would also say that there's a case for internationalizing local stories. I and some of my students attended a Mitt Romney event. He talked about China about a third of the time, and I would say the one line that he gave, which, boy, if I were working for the Romney campaign, I'd advise them to work it into their strategy for ads, was he said he was asked about budget cutting, and he said, you know, I'm going to cut things based on the following question, whether it's worth borrowing money from China to pay for this. And that got the most audience reaction in the room, the most sustained applause and the most interest, I would say. As far as I could tell, nobody who covered that story picked up on that. And I wonder whether we get so locked into thinking, oh, we've got to talk about the candidate's position on the local issue of 12 on downtown. And we don't think that maybe the public is interested in the international perspective on things as much as maybe some reporters are.
From what do we do when we sense that the public is a bit fatigued? Do we let up a little? Do we find a different angle? Derek, have you faced this before?
Well, I hear from people very frequently who say enough of various types of stories. And I always do bring that feedback back to the editors. And I think they do use that as a little bit of a barometer. And also, one of the things that they do have today is, for example, real-time monitoring of what gets hits on the website. And so they actually know a little bit more about that in a scientific way than they used to. But again, you've got the age-old question of, is it important and does it need to be out front? And I do definitely hear criticism when people feel the Star has underplayed something because it might not be as sexy as another story that is of a lot less import that got more prominent play to it. And again, that's those news hounds, and those are those people who are contacting me who are just a different type of reader.
816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org. Russ in Kansas City, Kansas, wants to know if the media critics think the news media has become too inclusive. Are there too many stories getting attention that aren't really newsworthy? That's an interesting question. Sylvia?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. I mean, I'd be interested to hear what type of examples of stories he's thinking of, whether they're sort of human interest stories. I mean, there's so much out there right now that you can certainly avoid the things that you don't think are worth reading. But, you know, there's a lot of people who want to hear a good nonfiction story in the newspaper or on the radio that's not necessarily a newsy story.
Derek Donovan?
I do think you also have a certain undercurrent of people who suggest that in years past, if you had somebody who was essentially a stunt candidate who, you know, said very provocative things and said things that were inaccurate and just, you know, not a very serious candidate, had no real chance of getting the nomination, would the news media have covered that person, taken them seriously 30 years ago? I think that there's probably a fairly good argument that when you had, I think, more sort of guardians of adjudicating what is actually legitimately a possibility politically, that you probably would not have seen as much of. I'm sorry, I might take some flack here, but for example, Michelle Bachmann, you know, somebody who is saying things to fire up a base, but does not really have any legitimate chance at getting the nomination. Do you really kind of do a disservice to the news by presenting people like that as though they're serious candidates on the same footing as the other ones who do actually stand, a real chance?
And for those of you who are interested, you'll find Derek Donovan's email address on our website at kcur.org. This is predicted to be a very good financial year for TV stations, that is. They make lots of money on political ads, or do they? David Perlmutter?
Well, yes. There's no question that you want to sell ad time in Iowa. From the past week or so, the TV stations are taking that money and doing rather well with it. And it's political speech. It has to be paid for. I think there's been some studies done that show that the Iowa caucuses are not necessarily this economic boom to the entire state, that somehow we're making a killing over here on it. Some people would claim that Iowa loses a little bit of money because of all the time that's taken up. If you just think of the mechanics of the Iowa caucus, of all the people having to go there and spend many hours, I guess if we bill the rest of the country for that time, that would be quite expensive. So certainly contested races, TV news especially, TV stations love that. But that's true of like New York City as much as Iowa City.
Hmm. And I'm guessing it's probably the same in Kansas City, but how about once the general election comes around? Is Iowa going to see the same influx of TV commercial money that they do right now? Or is it going to be a little bit less because then
no,
the campaigns
we are
realize
loved,
that Iowa
we are
really
loved
doesn't matter?
And then we're loved and then left behind.
Hmm.
the spotlight, we all know, you know, here the spotlight will move elsewhere, and Iowa is a potential swing state, and I would be surprised in a general election where you wouldn't see some politicking in Iowa. But no, we know this is our moment, and then you will just forget about us and move on to your other concerns.
Hmm. Derek Donovan, do candidates still advertise in the newspaper, and how about the Star's website?
They do, and sometimes to the great chagrin of the people who do not like their politics. I honestly would say the angriest response I have ever heard in my years on this job came from one year. I'm not going to name who the candidate was, but one of the national candidates bought the poly bag, the plastic bag that home subscribers get their paper
yes.
in. That is available for political ads, or it was at the time. Don't quote me on that. They may have decided they're not going to take those any longer. But having the Star come wrapped in a bag that had an ad for a candidate who, by the way, the Star's editorial board had not endorsed, really infuriated a lot of readers. And so there's a certain tie to the printed word that I think is very different from broadcast. And now, of course, we have ads that are broadcast over the air that have to have the disclaimer at the end, you know, from the candidate saying that he paid for and approves this message, he or she, I'm sorry. And so it's a different type of thing. I think that people are sometimes able to distinguish broadcast commercials from newspaper ads in a little bit different way, even if they intellectually understand it's the same thing. There's just something about seeing it right in front of you that does tend to be fairly controversial for some readers.
And it gives kind of – was it controversial because it was the other candidate there on their doorstep, or was it controversial because it gave implicit – because some people thought the Star was endorsing that candidate?
I think there was a little bit of both. It was also a candidate who was just an extremely divisive person, and people who hated this person, I mean, hated him. And so it's a little bit of both.
Hmm. We have this email from Jason in Overland Park. As a political science major, I'm worried about the direction of media, especially as it relates to politics. It seems as society's attention spans get shorter and shorter, it becomes more and more difficult to discern truth from propaganda. Interesting. Sylvia?
And I think we haven't really talked about horse race coverage, which is exactly what happens around this time. And you know, who's up, who's down, who made what attack, and what was the response, which often those attacks and responses are not getting at the media issues in terms of how this person would govern and what their policy, approach would be. And the media, I think, does play a part in that, needs to sometimes step back and look at the allocation of resources to covering these daily press conferences and to doing the investigations of looking into what somebody's record is, what somebody's policies would be, what people are saying about them. And I think there's another aspect of that.
Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. But this brings up an interesting point. What is our responsibility to bring up to mention websites like FactCheck.org or VoteSmart? You know, these, like you were saying, these records, and or do we tend to shy away from those because we don't want to send people to another place?
No, I mean, actually, that's what I was going to say. I think that the rise of that has contributed to, I think, political reporting in the past 4 years of this idea of fact-checking. And, I mean, fact-checking is supposed to be part of journalism,
right,
no matter what. But I think these organizations, factcheck.org, really have driven it.
And one of the great advantages that we're now in the third president who's been around during the internet age. This is one of the things that I think people are really losing in the rush towards social media, social media, social media. I'm so tired of hearing people talk about it for the past couple of years. One of the great resources of the open web is that you have got things like, for example, PolitiFact that puts these fact checks up and documents them and leaves them up. and makes them easy to find. You know, I wrote a column just earlier this week about something that dates back to 2009. Good luck finding that on Twitter or on Facebook.
Hmm,
but, you
point.
Know, PolitiFact, St. Petersburg's Times, is keeping that up and available. It's basically a reference library that would have been possible for people to have found. But, you know, 20 years ago, a newspaper would have written a debunking of a political ad, and then it would have gone into the microfilm stacks. And to seek that out when somebody would rehash those same political claims in a couple of years would be a lot more difficult. So it's a huge resource that I don't think you can even draw a parallel to two generations ago.
Hmm. David Perlmutter, what are some of your favorite places to find facts or check your facts?
Well, I do have access to a library, and I sort of like it.
Library. I've heard that term before.
Yeah, I can give you a tour if you ever visit here, if you're familiar with what its purposes are. Yes, we live in a golden age of information if we want to use it and if we think that it's important. And I think that is really the challenge, is raising generations of Americans who not only can use the technology and are facile with every kind of social media that exists out there, but will take that extra effort to go say, you know, I'm going to go check that. I'm going to go look it up. And there's just innumerable places that where you can do that. So it really, at the end of the day, it's up to us as individuals, as citizens, to use the media to get the information we need to make decisions. And we can only critique the media so far when they're not giving us in any one particular story or any one particular venue that information.
Hmm. Have we become lazy media consumers? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Back to the notion of campaign commercials and ads again. How will these so-called super PACs, unlimited fund, anonymous donor, political action committees, affect spending this year? David Perlmutter?
Oh, well, this is definitely the big story coming out of Iowa, which you will be receiving with great alarm and pleasure, I guess, in the rest of the country, is that this is the year of the super PAC, and the 2 years of the super PAC going into 2012, probably decisive. I mean, I think Gingrich was slammed down not just by ads from opponents, but a lot of money coming in from these sort of vague pro-Romney or sometimes pro-Paul super PACs from out of state. That is going to be very interesting how that plays out, because we are potentially talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in ad buys and negative ad buys in the year to come.
Derek Donovan, is the Star counting on some extra ad revenue this year?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I'm going to call our VP of advertising. You know, the main thing that what David's talking about, though, that brings up in my head is that, boy, what an opportunity for journalism. And if I were somebody who was directing political reporters right now, boy, if you could figure out who is behind some of these shadowy dollars, that is the story, I think. Now, whether you can get to that and whether it's going to be worth your investment, that's the question that each individual editor has to make.
Hmm. Well, we've heard plenty of best of list shows at the end of last year and some biggest stories of 2011, the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, Baby Lisa, Google Fiber. Derek, Sylvia, and David, what mistakes did we make? And more importantly, I'm stealing this question from On the Media. What will most likely go wrong in 2012? Sylvia, let's start with you. What are we going to do wrong in 2012? And then I want to hear about your biggest, most over and undercovered stories.
Well, I think I've hit this in many shows, but the lack of coverage of state news, state legislatures, and what's happening in those legislatures, I think sees a decline sort of across the board here in Kansas City.
Derek Donovan, what are we going to do wrong this year?
You know, I think what we're going to do wrong is what we continue to do wrong, which is to prognosticate. It's the kind of thing that drives me crazy, because we constantly write these stories about, one I recall on the way here, the coming tripling of the price of peanut butter. Well, that didn't happen. And, you know,
not yet.
That's right. And you can always make the argument that by forewarning people about these things that might be happening, you can sort of forestall it then. And so you've got a little bit of a chicken and egg. But it's the kind of story that I'm not particularly big on. And I certainly wish that journalism in general would do a little bit less of it.
David Perlmutter, what mistakes are we going to make this year?
Oh, I completely agree with what was just said about predicting. And it's funny, I did a study years ago where I looked at predictions in news magazines. This is over a 40-year period. And there was this really funny pattern of they would make a prediction about what would happen. It didn't happen. And then they would attack people in government who had bet on that prediction and changed policy to fit sort of the prediction. Arab Spring is a very good example. You know, I really wish during the coverage of the Arab Spring revolts and changes in government, a lot of experts had gotten on television and say, gee, we have no idea what's going to happen. Wow, big unknown. Instead, we had all these people pontificating on what exactly would happen. As usual, half of them were exactly wrong. I don't see any mass resignation of foreign policy experts, as usual. And I see the same people being quoted on new predictions of where the Arab Spring will go. I really wish people would be more held accountable for predictions. By the way, the price of peanut butter is going to rise 3,000%.
Thank you for that prediction. In the few seconds we have left, the most overcovered and undercovered story, Sylvia, most overcovered story of 2011.
Well, besides some of the more tabloidy stories, I think I'm going to say maybe the death of Steve Jobs. Treated as a head of state.
Here come all the Apple fans. Derek Donovan, yeah, most overcovered story of 2011.
Sylvia stole my thunder. I was definitely going to say Jobs was definitely overcovered. Undercovered, I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for a big investigation of what's going on with the Power and Light District in Kansas City. And there are suggestions that there are deeper troubles there that I think is ripe for the pick.
National perspective, David Perlmutter from Iowa. What was the most overcovered story last year?
I think that the political campaign was covered too much. Undercovered, definitely, again, the real estate crisis.
Thank you all very much. Our media critics, Derek Donovan from the Kansas City Star, Sylvia Maria Gross from KCUR, and David Perlmutter, director of the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communications. Thank you all very, very much. Biographies of our guests, previous broadcasts, and podcasts can be found on our website, kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the year ahead in environmental news. Is one of your New Year's resolutions to reduce, reuse, or recycle? That's tomorrow on the program. We had help today from Tamika Weatherspoon, Kim Noble, and Maria Carter. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. I'm Steven Steigman, and for Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.